Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Hey, it's Anna. This week, we're sharing an episode of a new podcast called The Experiment with you. It's produced by our colleagues at WNYC Studios and The Atlantic. It's a show about America, and it's good. One recent episode looked at the high rates of deaths among Filipino-American healthcare workers from COVID and how that connects to U.S. immigration policy. Another included a long interview with a historian, a white guy from Virginia, who was in his 40s when he reconsidered what he'd been taught about Confederate General Robert E. Lee and Southern gentlemen more generally. I think Death, Sex, and Money listeners especially will appreciate this episode that we're sharing today. It's about a man in Indiana who got an email that he could have ignored, but he didn't. It's a story about faith and duty and the death penalty. My colleague Julia Longoria hosts The Experiment. Here she is.
Alvin, I don't think I've ever said your last name out loud. How do I say it?
It's Melleth.
Melleth?
Melleth.
Am I doing that right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Alvin Melleth, why are we here today?
Why are you using my government name like that?
Alvin Melleth is a producer at The Experiment. And we started talking about something he's been thinking about for a while now.
So this summer in July, I saw that the federal government had executed someone. And I remember reading about it in the news at the time and being a little surprised by it because, you know, there are states that do executions regularly, but the federal government hasn't actually executed someone in 17 years. Like the last time was 2003. There were none in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Like it's just not a thing that we do very often.
Huh. I didn't fully realize it had been that long.
Yeah, I hadn't either. And I think I was like actually trying to make sense of how to feel about it. And then 2 days later, they executed someone else. And then a day after, they executed someone else. And then two more in the next month. And then two more the month after that. And I just couldn't stop thinking about the fact that the federal government says they do this on our behalf. It's just a weird thing to have the government kill someone on your behalf. Like war and the death penalty, right? It's like the two times that someone does violence in your name. I just felt really far away from it. And I wanted to try to get closer to it or at least try to understand exactly what's being done in my name. So I started reading about each of the executions. And one of the things I found out was that these killings were all actually happening in the same room in the U.S. penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. And at each of these executions, there would be the person being executed and the prison officials, you know, one with a stethoscope to declare the time of death. But the eighth execution was for a man named Orlando Hall. He was a black man from Arkansas who was found guilty of murder by an all-white jury. And for him, there was one other person in the room. He wasn't a prison official. He had nothing to do with the case. He was just a civilian. And so I called him.
My name is Yusuf Ahmed Noor. I am a professor at the business school, Indiana University, Kokomo, and I teach strategic management and international business.
He's a business professor?
What was a business professor doing in a death chamber?
He answered an email to be Orlando's spiritual advisor. I didn't know about this at first, but in the U.S., we've decided that the First Amendment gives people on death row the right to a spiritual advisor from whatever religion they belong to. And so Yusuf, who wasn't paid to be there, just sort of stepped into this whole thing. He volunteered to do it, actually. And I think I wanted to know what kind of a person does that and what he saw.
I never thought I'm an emotional person. But every time I remember and I talk about my experience in the death chamber, I become emotional. Every time I talk about it, I feel emotional about it.
Yeah. Well, if there's a point where it just feels like you need to take a little break, that's completely okay.
Yeah, it's going to be just a pause. I'll be quiet maybe for a few seconds.
That's okay.
Yeah.
This week, a conversation with a man who got very close to the death penalty in the United States. Producer Alvin Melleth brings us the story of a man who couldn't look away. I'm Julia Longoria. This is The Experiment, a show about our unfinished country.
You know, I'm of nomadic background. I was born in the nomadic area of Somalia.
Yusuf Ahmed Noor grew up in Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia.
It was one of the quietest towns right on the Indian Ocean. I grew up swimming, just warm weather, humid, but absolutely gorgeous. I loved it.
Outside of the water, though, Yusuf said he had a pretty unhappy childhood. Both of his parents died when he was 5 years old. He was raised by an aunt in a country that was under a military dictatorship. He spent a lot of time by himself. One of the only ways he found to escape was through books.
There are so many things that are unexplained things. Reading makes you, it broadens your mind, it broadens your horizon, it makes you think about things.
He got a membership to the American Library to practice his English, and he started reading all of these books about the U.S.
I read almost everything about the United States, you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin. I remember reading Roots, the autobiography of Malcolm X, Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind, To Kill a Mockingbird. And so I guess they were popular at the time, and I absolutely did not get it. I totally missed the message and the nuances, because come from Somalia where, you know, nothing like that exists. Somalia is very homogeneous. The concept of black, it doesn't exist in Africa. You know, this color that Americans are so fixated on doesn't exist. People don't think they're black there. The first time you hear that you're black is here in America when people describe you. And then you look around, are they talking about me? You know, something like that. And so you don't, it doesn't register with you.
In some ways, Yusuf has always been an observer of the U.S., on the outside, looking in. He first came here in 1986 to do an MBA program. He never actually intended to stay.
It was purely accidental. I was going to go back, but then things were getting worse.
Back in Somalia, Yusuf's friends were starting to agitate for democracy. The military dictatorship there arrested a lot of them, even threatened some with execution. Yusuf thought that if he went back, he'd be in the same boat. So he applied for political asylum in the U.S. and got it. He got married to a white woman from the South and suddenly found himself with two American kids.
What really surprised me was that I have two sons. They don't take the kind of risks that I take. Like, to give you an example, my son and I went to get a motorcycle. He's trying to get me into motorcycle riding. So we went to a town that's about 2 hours drive from here, and he wanted to pee. And, you know, I ride bikes, and if I need to pee, I just stop and go behind a tree. I don't give a second thought at all, you know. But he was very careful. He was thinking, I don't know how people will react to me if they see me there. And my son could easily pass for an Arab. You know, he's mixed. He would blend in. He doesn't stand out as, you know, black. So it really surprised me that his attitude about what he can do and how worried he is about how people would view him and how they would react. And we went back and forth and back and forth, and it never really crossed my mind that he developed that kind of attitude. And it's because he was brought up here. He's hearing everything, you know, all the racial issues and all the racial ramifications, that kind of attitude of taking risks and not worrying about how people will react or what they would say. And just, it may be part of the Somali character, I don't know, but I still have that Somali attitude. And I find it's really strange, the kind of risk, quote unquote, risks that I take.
Throughout his career, Yusuf ended up teaching all over the country. But no matter where he went in the U.S., he always made it a point to find a mosque.
I have always been, since I came here, I've always been involved in the Muslim communities. Wherever I go, I have always been very active.
He'd gone to Muslim elementary schools and high schools. He'd grown up reading the Quran. So when he finally landed in Bloomington, Indiana, he did what he always did. He got involved with his local mosque.
I'm one of the elders, and I'm also involved in the multi-faith movement in Bloomington. We do a lot of interfaith things with them. And so a minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church emailed us about Orlando.
And what did the email say?
It said that there's a man who's on death row and he needs a Muslim person to be his counselor, his spiritual counselor.
The execution was slated to happen in a few weeks at the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute, just an hour's drive from Bloomington. They needed someone familiar with Islam to counsel the man. But the mosque in Bloomington is all volunteer. There's no paid clergy who would be the sort of default person to do this.
So it's kind of a very democratic religion in that respect. So after maybe a week, I didn't see any response to that. So I asked if anybody responded to that email, and they said no, nobody has responded.
So Yusuf Googled the man on death row. His name was Orlando Hall. In 1995, Orlando was convicted of the kidnapping, rape, and murder of a 16-year-old named Lisa Renee. He and another man drove Lisa from her home in the back of a car. They poured gasoline over her, and then they buried her alive. Orlando was 23 at the time. When Yusuf got the email, Orlando had been on death row for more than 20 years.
When you had gotten the email originally and read it, what was your feeling? Was your feeling someone else is going to do this?
Yeah, I was thinking that that somebody would do it. But deep down, I knew that, you know, in general, things that are unpleasant, it usually falls on me. So I decided to do it the moment I realized that nobody else was going to do it.
Why not just let the email go?
You know, you have a fellow human being who is on death row, and they're going to kill him. And so it was, I didn't really think about it. It's just like this guy needs help and he's seeking somebody to talk to. And that's the least you can do. It entails some sacrifice, but it's not compared to what he's going through. What I'm going to do is a piece of cake.
So Yusuf decided to meet Orlando. He drove about an hour to Terre Haute, went in.
And I was accompanied by this prison official who took me through multiple heavy metal doors, through an elevator, and finally to the visitation room, where I was on one side of the room and he's on the other side of the room, and we're separated by a glass wall.
So what do you first say to Orlando?
Well, you know, greeting, Muslim greetings, peace be with you in Arabic. That was our first exchange. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Wa alaikum salam. The allocated time is from 9 till 3. And I spent those 6 hours with him that first time. But one thing that I wanted to know was whatever he did, that he was contrite, that he was sorry, that he was regretful. And so it's one of the first things that we talked about. And it was very clear to me that he regretted what he did or the role that he played in the killing of that young woman. Whether he was guilty or not, I decided that that part was not my job. That was not my role. Right away, I could see that he was already, you know, reconciled to his fate. He was not nervous. He was ready. Part of Islamic teaching is that everybody's going to die. It's not about how you die. It's everybody has a time and a day and an hour where they die, and you just accept it. And so he was reconciled, despite the fact that he didn't believe that he should die.
And what kind of questions did he have for you?
We talked about Islam in general. He studied thoroughly Islam. He knew a lot. He brought his books. He brought a copy of the Quran in English. And so we talked about, religious concepts, religious philosophy. We talked about the death penalty in Islam. And so we also talked about the political side of American executions and the fact that the rate of executions is much higher. And the rate of incarceration in America is much higher. You know, more African Americans are incarcerated percentage-wise than whites. And, you know, he even mentioned the fact that this string of executions, they started with a white guy. And he said, you know, who do they think they are fooling? They started with a white guy just to show that they're not targeting African Americans. But he said, they're not fooling anybody. 2/3 of the people there in death row in Terre Haute, he said, were non-white.
Yusuf met with Orlando 2 more times. And through his lawyer, Orlando asked Yusuf for one final favor. If Yusuf would be in the room with him when the execution happened.
And I said, I don't want to do that. I really don't want to be there. But if he wants me to be there, I am going to be there. That's the least I can do.
The day of the execution, Yusuf made the long drive to Terre Haute through the changing leaves on State Road 46. He met with Orlando first thing in the morning, and they went over last rites. And then he waited. Later that night, a guard brought him into the execution room.
The victim is lying down on the gurney, right in the middle of the room, closer to the wall. The opposite wall, one of the long walls, the opposite wall is where the windows are, glass windows. And so I could see the windows that are the media and the family room, and Orlando could see them because the gurney, the torso part is raised a little bit. So he can see that. He can see them while lying down there, strapped to the gurney.
And where are you standing?
I'm standing right beside him. And on each side of the gurney are the executioners, one on each side. And by the time we got there, he was already strapped on the gurney. He was covered with what looked like a hospital blanket. It's like it was deliberately designed to make it look like a benign surgical operation in a hospital. And so I was not allowed to approach him before they start releasing the poison. I have to stand, keep a distance from the gurney. Orlando and I'm talking, and I would, you know, I've already explained to him what we would be doing, the last rites that he would recite. And he, on his own, I mean, he started doing it on his own. I really didn't have to help him in any way. He just started reciting on his own. And he kept reciting, and even after they started releasing the poison. He was reciting the prayers that he knew in Arabic. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, Maliki Yawm al-Din, Iyaka Na'budu wa Iyaka Nasta'in, Ihdina al-Sirat al-Mustaqim, Sirat al-Ladina al-Amta alayhim.
How did you know when he was gone?
He stopped reciting. And then within seconds, his mouth opened wide, like he started yawning. And later on, I read yawning. That's an indication that they can't breathe. They're trying to breathe, but they can't. So it's like drowning. And so he yawned a number of times, at least three times. And then he was gone. The time that you are waiting, that's the most difficult time. That's when you start thinking. That's when it hits you. You know, it's quiet. Nobody's saying anything. Everybody's waiting for the doctor to come and pronounce him dead. That's when it hits you how surreal it is, how absurd it is.
Back when Yusuf first took the assignment to counsel Orlando, it felt simple to him, instinctual even. He saw a fellow human being in need, and he decided he'd help. But that moment after Orlando died, the whole thing stopped feeling so simple.
I'm in this room, and I am participating in the killing of a fellow human being just a few hours ago. Was healthy, they assign you a role to play in this execution. That's when all these thoughts crowd into your mind.
The aftermath, after the break.
Hey, it's Anna. Just popping in to say that it is not too late to sign up for our first ever Pick Up the Phone and Call Day this Friday, March 26th. It's a holiday we invented to encourage all of you to think about who you will pick up the phone and call on this Friday. Maybe it's someone you've fallen out of touch with or someone who's just been through a lot in the past year. Text the words Call Day to 70101, and we'll send you some helpful tips and a reminder on the holiday. And if you can't think of anyone to call, we'll send you some ideas for that too. Next week, we are taking a break in the podcast feed. If you are behind on your death, sex, and money listening, I really encourage you to go back and do some digging in our archives. Definitely do not miss our recent episode about a Texas strip club, your stories about life after 60, or our producer Afi Yellow Duke's conversations with listeners about being in immigrant families in the U.S. right now. We'll be back the week after next with an episode with poet and essayist Claudia Rankine, who talks about her cancer diagnosis and its impact on her relationship with her husband.
I think my initial reaction to the cancer diagnosis and the treatment was to want to flee. You know, the fantasy is that you could do it a different way. It's almost like I had a midlife crisis. But instead of it being brought on by middle age, it was brought on by illness.
Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. but they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen. And her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Dakota Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
A little before midnight, on November 19th, the United States executed Orlando Hall. Yusuf was standing right beside him.
And, you know, it's all these thoughts that crowd your mind.
Yusuf looked around the room. Once Orlando was gone, it was just him and the executioners.
You just, how surreal it is, how, like, we are the high priests of this sacrifice that we're sacrificing. It begs to go back thinking about, you know, when people used to sacrifice humans to their gods. It's like that we are the high priests and we are sacrificing this human being to satisfy some kind of a, not, you know, religious rite, but a secular rite.
Did you feel like one of those high priests too?
Yeah, exactly. That's, you know, it hits me that I am participating in this and I am playing a role that they assigned me to kind of legitimize what they're doing or furnish this religious spiritual side where they are providing the secular side of the sacrifice. When you're left to your thoughts, you say, see, that's exactly how they planned it. But then I will correct myself and say the only reason I'm there is because if it were not for him wanting me to be there, I wouldn't be there. And by the way, that's when it hit me why he wanted me to be there. Because in that room, I was the only friend he had. The other people there came to kill him. I was the only one he could look and say, you know, that person doesn't intend any evil towards me.
What were you, like, thinking on your drive back?
Oh, before I went home, I was... I did not expect it to affect me the way it did. It was really traumatic. And I was really angry. I was very angry. I was angry at the whole system that brought us to that point. It's the system that allows them to do that. It's the system that segregates people. It's the system. That's what you need to tackle, is the system that allows that to happen time and time again. And those who perpetuate it, and those who support it, and those who benefit from it. You have to address that if you want this to change. Despite the trauma and the anger, and I'm glad I did it.
I mean, I think I was just trying to think about your choices here, your decision to opt in, because you're not actually doing the executing, but it does strike me that you made a choice here to involve yourself in something you didn't have to.
Well, you know, you can't solve a problem if you run away from it. You know, that's what I tell my children, because they're disgusted with the system here. My son that I told you we went to get motorcycles, he talks about it all the time. I want to move out of here. I want to, you know, move to Canada or New Zealand. And I said to him, look, during all this struggle, African-Americans struggling here, all the people who were killed during the civil rights movement, look how much they accomplished. Those who stayed put, those who worked hard. Some of the rights we enjoy here is because of their sacrifice. You were born here. You belong here. And things are going to get better. I have lived here in Bloomington, forget about anywhere else, longer than I lived anywhere else. So although I would enjoy being back in Somalia, but my children are here and my grandchildren are here, I'm not going anywhere. I will contribute to the struggle as much as I can.
Not long after Orlando was killed, Yusuf got another call. There was another Muslim man on death row named Dustin Higgs. Dustin, it turned out, needed a spiritual advisor too.
I just felt obligated, you know. This guy who's going to be executed, he wants you to be there. That's the least you can do. What else can you do? You can't say no. I mean, how can you say no?
On January 16th, 2021, Yusuf was present at the execution of Dustin Higgs. Dustin was the 13th and final person executed by the Trump administration.
Yes, I guess it's human nature to become inured to things. We can get used to almost anything. You know, like those guys whose job is to execute people, they get used to it. So I hope I never get used to it. But I wouldn't change what I did. I would do it again. I hope I never do it again. I hope that Dustin will make history and be the last person executed by the United States government. Let's hope.
That was Yusuf Ahmed Noor talking with Alvin Melith for the podcast The Experiment. A majority of Americans support the death penalty, though opposition to it is increasing. According to a 2020 Gallup poll, 55% of Americans support capital punishment for someone convicted of murder. 43% oppose it, the highest levels of opposition since 1966. Capital punishment is currently authorized in 28 states. 5 states have actually abolished it since 2009. That's not counting Nebraska, where the legislature abolished it in 2015, but voters reauthorized it with a statewide ballot vote a year later. This episode was produced by Alvin Melleth, along with Gabrielle Burbet and Julia Longoria, with editing by Matt Collette and Catherine Wells. Fact-checking by William Brennan. Sound design by David Herman. Music by Tasty Morsels and Nelson Nance. Special thanks to Najib Amini. The Experiment team also includes Natalia Ramirez, Tracy Hunt, and Emily Boteen. Yes, is also a member of the Death, Sex, and Money team. The rest of our team includes Yasmin Khan, Afi Yellow Duke, Andrew Dunn, and Katie Bishop, who also helped out with this episode. Our intern is Emily Tafour. If you like what you heard in this episode, make sure you head over to The Experiment in your podcast player and hit subscribe. I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.